Could you put a timeline on when you started working out this melodic, or is it chromatic? What is it?
Well, I would say, in all fairness, most of the tunes that I was into were more skeletic. They were more notes of a major scale. The word chromatic refers to the, let's say, the non-scalar notes. If you're in the key of C, which is the white keys on the piano, then the black keys are the chromatic tones in the C scale. And, of course, those appear in certain fiddle tunes, but my first, it's also, I mean, well, I still feel that the word chromatic started to apply when things got into a bluesy and a more angular way of playing.
Okay.
That was not my original approach, and I think, in all fairness, that that Bobby Thompson really brought, it was the first that I ever was aware of. Because Doug Dillard was, ask Doug Dillard, and I think he told me once that somebody came, brought a tape that they, across the country, of a jam session or something that I was playing in, and he heard this and worked for a while, and then out came Banjo in the Hollow, which has sort of a melodic little on the front of it.
Yeah.
And anyway, I think a lot of people working on it in their corner of the world, as far as Bobby goes, the part of that story is I never met Bobby until after I had worked with Bill Monroe. He had already worked with Jim and Jesse, and we know that he recorded quite a few things with them, including the Dixie Hoedown, one of my favorites, which has a little bit of that, well, rudiments of what turned into Bobby Thompson's style, I think. There are other things like Vangelina were pretty much straightforward Scruggsy rolls and not all that melodic. In fact, there's only the parts of the Dixie Hoedown that are. Fact is, when I began working with Bill Monroe in the spring of 63, Bobby Thompson was with the Army National Guard in I guess it was in South Carolina, wasn't it, where he lived?
I don't recall. Sounds familiar.
And he told me that he used to listen to Bill Monroe on the Opry at night, Saturday night, and when I was playing. When I met him later, he told me that he used to listen to me when I was with Monroe, and that's what I was featured on the fiddle tunes and stuff like, well, the stuff I recorded with Monroe, which included the six instrumentals, all of which had some melodic, a lot of melodic stuff in them. So I feel that could have had an influence on Bobby. Anyway, I don't feel responsible that, I mean, or I shouldn't say responsible. I didn't influence him, I don't think, in the direction, his direction, which he took, which was in the bluesy thing and the stuff he got into with the area code 615. And I was hewing closer to a major melodic sound, and he was more into a bluesy chromatic thing.
He had done, the way I hear the story, he had been doing a little of that even before he heard you doing it, even a little bit with Jim and Jesse, but it didn't go over very well, or maybe he didn't play it very well.
Somebody told me that too, but I've talked with Jim and Jesse themselves, and they say they don't really remember Bobby playing fiddle tunes, because when I got down to Nashville, there were a lot of people saying, wow, they never heard that before, and Jim and Jesse were among them. And in fact, I don't know when Bobby first heard me, but you know, with the recording with Jim Rooney, and wasn't that
That 62 with your Living on the Mountain thing?
Yes, well, that was released, and had, that's what I'm trying to get at. In the absolute timeline here, what happened coming out of the graduation in, let's say, June of 61, appendix operation in July of 61, and then in September of 61 is when Jim and I and Joe Val and Herb Applin and Herb mm-hmm. Hooven made that album, Living on the Mountain.
Uh-huh.
And Fritz Richmond played the bass on it. And that was in the September of 61, and then I went away to basic training in October. The record didn't come out until 62, and the liner notes had 62. But that's the first recording of my first recording of Devil's Dream. I think that's one reason why it looks so much later than the New Dimensions in Bluegrass. However, as I point out to you, I was playing that in 61 in the club with Rooney when Eric and Marshall came in.
Okay. Jim Smoke was doing a little of that too, wasn't he?
I had a record of his, and I wasn't all that aware. You know, Billy Fair did a lot of kind of fiddle tunes and Irish fiddle tunes using a hammering-on style, and he'd recorded the Sailor's Hornpipe. In fact, I guess you could even say that maybe the tune occurred to me as much because I'd heard it come out of a banjo. But there are the classical banjo players from going back towards the turn of the century, as well as one guitar player named he's a South American, and I think his name is Narciso Yepes. He had some recordings out and did concerts, and I saw him in Boston in the 60s, and he was using a 10-string guitar that had the top six strings as usual, but low strings were tuned. I can't tell you exactly how they were tuned, but he used positions up the neck and rolls to get melodic devices. And I remember seeing that in a concert, but I was already playing some melodic stuff at that time. My point is that it was happening on other instruments.
You're sort of influenced that way, so you just started picking it up on your main instrument.
Well,
because you're already doing it.
My inspiration was a fiddler.
Oh, okay.
And I heard a fiddler playing Devil's Dream, and I said, "Gee, those notes are in the. I can get them to come out in that order. I know where those notes are. I just have to, you know, not play rolls, but
uh-huh.
play notes, and they'll, and I can play them equally as." In the same way, and that was what that was really the winter of 59 to 60 that I first played the Devil's Dream, and at that point, it wasn't recorded until 61, One element I skipped in there is it was the summer of 61 when those other things happened, I believe late in the summer, when Jim Rooney and I went down to the Philadelphia Folk Festival, and the first Philadelphia Folk Festival, and won the banjo contest down there, and that was the winning tune.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me jump over to how Monroe received this. He loved your instrumentalism, you know, really. You had Kenny Baker in a band, and and you had some really great musicians. Did that make the band really successful?
Musically, the band was pretty successful. Economically, it was a tough time for Bill and Bluegrass in 63. I think Bill liked what I was doing. In fact, I'm sure he did. He wouldn't have asked me to join the band, I don't think, if he hadn't liked it. And the fact that he hadn't recorded for some time, but within 2 weeks or after I joined the band, he we practiced up and went into the studio, and recorded, as I said, six instrumentals.
Uh-huh.
And one vocal, and then we started whipping up some attention on the Opry, and I think some work started to come in, and so things were perking up. It seemed to me, I'm not trying to imply in any way that I'm even largely responsible for that, but it was great to be a part of that scene when things were picking back up, because it was a low ebb there. It was before the Bean Blossom Festival started, and there essentially
mm-hmm.
there was not much work and not much money around.
You stay with them about a year and a half, I guess, huh?
No, I began in the spring of 63 and played the last job he did in 63.
Oh.
So it was about 10 months or slightly less.
Did he break up the band then?
Well, no. In fact, you see, there were a couple of reasons that I decided to leave, but an important one for me was that the first job, well, after we were finished up in Los Angeles before Christmas of 63, and the next job was in the middle of January 64, and that job was to appear on the Hootenanny TV show. Well, as it turns out, since I'd begun playing the banjo with Pete Seeger, and unfortunately Pete Seeger had been blackballed from TV, essentially, because of what they perceived as leftist leanings, and that he essentially coined the word hootenanny and was responsible for the folk revival in the Northeast, at least. I felt a letter signed by the likes of Bob Dylan, Joan Baez, Judy Collins, and others whom I knew and respected, this letter was circulated in Sing Out and other avenues, suggesting that that those undersigned, the people on that signing that letter, would not appear on the Hootenanny show until Pete Seeger were invited on the show. And I kind of felt very sympathetic to that point of view.
Hmm.
He was really the first, the one that got me into the five-string banjo.
Mm-hmm.
So I also, as it turns out, once I had been reassigned to the military in Nashville, the monthly meetings down there started interfering with the work. I mean, actually, it was every 2 weeks in Nashville and on the weekends, and that's when we had it work. So I could see that. And then there was another reason on a more confidential level, at least not to blare in the print, but that Bill's daughter, Melissa, had started traveling with us, and she was actually very difficult to